From the University of Tulsa, this is Sacred and Profane Love, a podcast that explores how literature, philosophy, and theology can help us think more deeply about love, happiness, and meaning in human life. I am Jennifer Frey, Dean of the Honors College at TU, and your host. I invite you to join me and my guests, which range from award-winning fiction writers, poets, and literary critics, to philosophers and scholars from a range of disciplines, as we explore in conversation how the enjoyment of art might be, as the late philosopher and novelist Iris Murdoch has so provocatively suggested, a training in the love of virtue. I hope these conversations will enrich your life, inspire you to crack open some good books, and bring your attention back to what ultimately matters in the end. I am delighted to be in the studio this morning with the poet Carl Phillips. Winner of the 2023 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry, Phillips has also been a finalist for both the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, among many other literary honors. Phillips is the author of 15 books, most recently, Then the War and Selected Poems, 2007 to 2020. In addition to contemporary poetry, his academic interests include classical philology, translation, and the history of prosody in English. Welcome to the podcast, Carl.
Thank you, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this podcast. Normally, we go into some sort of deep dive into a work of literature, but we're not going to do that today. We're going to just have a very casual, fun conversation about classics, study of classics, the influence of classical literature on poetry, maybe poetry and philosophy, who knows? We'll see where this goes. I want to start by talking about something very near and dear to my heart, which is how to convince young people to study classic texts today. So I'm dean of an honors college. We have a curriculum that is grounded in classic texts and begins with classic texts proper, right? We begin with Homer and we begin with the Iliad. You studied classics as an undergraduate, which is extremely rare today. So my first question is, why did you want to study classics? What drew you to that as a young person?
That's a good question. Well, I was always interested in languages, and I used to, as a kid, create codes and things so my sisters couldn't read my diaries and all
that.
Oh,
really?
So my father, who was in the Air Force, we ended up being stationed in Germany. We moved there when I was 9 or 10.
Okay.
And it was required to take conversational German, which I was fascinated by. I never had learned a foreign language. So 4 years later, when we came back to the States, German wasn't offered at the high school that I entered. And there was a spot in a Latin 1 class.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up doing that and loving it. But my whole plan had been to be a veterinarian and major in biochem. And my Latin teachers, I ended up studying it for 4 years in high school. My Latin teachers made me promise that I would take a beginning Greek course in freshman year just to try it.
Because they just thought you had a knack, or?
I think they thought he is a classics person in the making.
Okay.
And he just doesn't know it.
Right.
So I signed up for my baby Greek class along with organic chemistry and calculus and all of that in freshman year. And one night I had this crisis moment where I burst into tears over an organic chemistry problem set.
And I Many realized, such cases.
Yes. And I thought, I don't like this. I don't think I like anything I'm studying except this Greek course, which I found really hard, but I actually wanted to go to it every morning. So I abandoned my veterinarian plans and thought, I can always get a dog.
Right.
Which is what I now have. And But you don't have to be a veterinarian just because you love animals. And here I am.
Right. So it was really a love of language.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
How do you fall in love with a dead language? So just to put my cards on the table, I'm a philosopher, but I was a classics minor.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically minored in Latin, right? So I took the Latin all the way through. I did not love Greek.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough.
Yeah.
Latin was such a beautiful, rigorous, logical language, and I loved learning it. I thought Latin poetry and philosophy was really beautiful and moving. And then learning Latin is really useful. Right? Because so much of the intellectual tradition is in Latin, and the Latin just keeps getting easier. Like, if you can read Cicero, you're basically fine for everything that comes after that. It's going to be, in some sense, easier. But I found Greek really hard. And basically impenetrable. So what was it?
Yeah, well, you're right. I think it's much harder. I always, even when I was in the thick of majoring in it, when I would turn to the Greek page, I would have this moment of panic and think, I can't read this because it's not in the alphabet that I know.
Right.
So there's that wall. And then I would remember, oh, you know these letters and you know what this is. But it's hard to stay fluent in Greek as opposed to Latin.
Right.
That doesn't seem to go away.
Right.
But that's not answering your question. How does one fall in love with a dead language? I think it might have to do with my personality that I'm not instinctively interactional and conversational. I thought it was a relief that these languages couldn't be spoken.
Really?
So, yes. So I thought, okay, we never have to sit around and pretend to be having sandwiches on the riverbank the way we did in my German class.
Right, sure.
So I thought it was exciting to just focus on the language itself, but also it was an entryway into a whole culture I didn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I thought ancient Romans were just amazing. It never occurred to me that they were actually horrible in other ways and destroying other places. And one sees how fascism comes from them. But at the time, I thought they're also very smart and have wonderful literature, as do the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I mentioned how I used to create these codes. So to me, there's the same pleasure in unlocking a code, mm-hmm. translating a language. But for some reason, because it's static in the sense of being dead, it feels more code-like. I guess I trust it more, too, because it can't change on you. Whereas I did study Italian, and then when I went to Italy, to Rome, no one understood me. And then they explained to me that I was speaking the Florence dialect.
Sure. Yeah.
So because my teacher had been from Florence.
Yeah.
So just those shifts. Whereas if you know Latin, you know Latin. And
right.
There is a yes or no answer.
Right.
Which I love about the grammatical certainty as opposed to, say, teaching poetry. You know.
Yeah. So, I mean, where does poetry enter into it for you? And I mean, first of all, I should say that I love that you were still in this headspace where you could just study what you loved.
Yeah.
I feel like no one's in that headspace anymore. I mean, so that's problem number one for classics.
Yeah.
This idea that I just loved it, so obviously, you know, I got a degree in it.
Mm-hmm.
That way of thinking seems to have been entirely destroyed. But yeah, I mean, where does poetry enter into this?
Well, some of it is that when I was in high school, I read, for example, in translation, a book of Sappho's poems. And I was fascinated how she was speaking about feelings, about love, desire, things like that. But it seemed very contemporary, and yet she was very long ago. So I was already interested in poetry anyway. My mother had written poems for fun for my sisters and me, and so it was kind of in the household. At first, sure, you end up translating things like Plato, we've talked about Cicero, Caesar. But when I found the poetry, which actually I find even the Latin poetry is really hard sometimes to translate, but the poems themselves are so beautiful. And I was excited about the idea of being able to read them in the original and see how that was different from what I thought it said or what I've been told it said. But I do sometimes, even though I wrote poems the way I think many teenagers do in high school, I wasn't really thinking seriously about being a poet. I still don't really know exactly what that is. But I do sometimes think that my study of Greek tragedy in senior year of college is what locked me in to poetry, though I didn't know it yet.
Okay.
Because as far as I know, all the tragedies, what they seem to have in common is conflict between how society thinks you should behave and how an individual decides to behave.
Mm-hmm.
And it's irreconcilable. And though I hadn't processed it yet, I think that one spoke in some way to my being biracial and having grown up feeling like I wasn't quite one thing or the other or not what people expected. And then it was still quite a while before I was going to figure out I was queer. But that, too, is another way in which, I mean, I was aware that people had expectations of how I was supposed to set up my life. And I was aware that that didn't make sense to me. So in that sense, I still think my poems exist at that same nexus that happens in Greek tragedy. Of how do we want to behave and conduct our bodies, but how do people think we should? And how do you stay living in that crossroads?
Is there a strand of the tragic running throughout your poetry?
Well, here I don't remember exactly the technical definitions of tragedy, but I think of tragedy.
Oh, there are rival and competing.
Yes, I guess that's the problem.
So don't worry, you're free.
Well, I think of tragedy as someone, as some hero figure, insisting on their individuality because they have no choice and owning it in the face of what would like to destroy that or what runs counter to it. So there's a weird, sometimes it's bravery, but sometimes it's just, you can't help it. You're this kind of person and you insist on yourself, though everywhere around you, there are these competing forces. Mm-hmm. And if that's tragic, then yeah, I guess that's a strain of what goes mm-hmm. on in my poems. But again, kind of like when you said how unusual it is for people to just fall in love with something and decide to study it. Maybe I'm just strange in that way. I just always have felt like, why wouldn't you do what you want to do? Why wouldn't you feel what you feel? And it's not that I don't feel peer pressure mm-hmm. and feel bad when people sort of judge things. But at the same time, I think, do we have any choice in what we can do? And, you know, or if someone says, why don't you write a poem about this? I think, because I can't, mm-hmm. but I write this kind of poem. Mm-hmm. If you like it, you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I do think you have a choice. I studied philosophy, mm-hmm. which, you know, my parents were not thrilled with that choice.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were like, why would you do that? And the answer was, I fell in love with philosophy. I mean, I didn't even know what philosophy was.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought philosophy was something that happened centuries ago. And I had no idea that this was a thing that one could do. But I absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the first time that I had experienced that intellectually, the kind of intellectual love.
Yeah.
Or an erotic impulse that was, yeah, intellectual. Mm-hmm. And wanting to pursue that sort of desire wherever it goes. I mean, my whole life has been in higher education. And I would say students now, they either don't understand that the life of the mind is driven by love, mm-hmm. or they just approach study in a completely and relentlessly utilitarian way. So it's all about mm-hmm. what kind of job am I going to get, which is why classics and philosophy mm-hmm. and increasingly even literature,
yeah.
right, are struggling to find students. And when you struggle to find students, you struggle to stay alive.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, I hate sounding like that kind of person back in my day, but it was different.
Yeah.
It was. And
we're allowed to do that now.
Yeah. And I do think I, in a weird way, lucked out that neither of my parents had gone to college and they had no knowledge of even things like how you apply to college or anything. It mm-hmm. wasn't like this world where people know from mm-hmm. the age of 10 where they want to go and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I think my parents, all they wanted was that I would go to college. Mm-hmm. And when I told them I was changing majors from pre-med to classics, they didn't even know what that was. I just said, it's a study of languages. And they thought, oh, that's great. You'll be able to maybe get a job as an interpreter or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So I figured they can...
Interpreting Homer.
Yes, they can run with that. Because I notice my students now have parents who are very career-minded, understandably. So I get it. My poetry students often will say they're secretly taking this poetry class while they do their other things that mm-hmm. their parents know about, even though I always want to tell them, your parents probably know you're in a poetry class. It's the internet exists. But yeah, you're right. It has become much more utilitarian.
Well, I mean, what would your elevator pitch be to young people now to study classics, study poetry? Why, if, for example, current trends continue, then most universities won't have classics departments. You'll mm-hmm. always have classics at Harvard and Yale, and mm-hmm. it's kind of well-endowed schools that can afford them as a luxury. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a classics department anymore at the University of Tulsa.
Mm, that's sad.
It is very sad.
Yeah.
I find it very sad, and I would like to bring it back, but I have to have students.
Yeah.
So what's your elevator pitch?
Well, what it would be, whether or not this is convincing, I feel that classical literature is never not contemporary and never irrelevant. And I would want to say that it's all of it, the history of what it is to be a human being in a body at a given moment. And that's what literature is in general. And to understand just the opportunity to think about, for example, we have a lot of wars going on at the moment, mm-hmm. usually do. And to look at something like the Iliad mm. and say, you know, this is a book about many things, but we could talk about war, not as people fighting, because that happens. But that poem shows so much about the human individuals behind it. And mm-hmm. just in that example, if we could think more about that, we might be more hesitant to engage in war or more mindful of, sometimes it seems like this big abstract thing happening on mm-hmm. online. And
yeah.
So it's the history of love. It's the history of betrayal and classical literature. It contains all of that. Even what I was saying about Greek tragedy, that idea of, your individuality versus the society that you live inside. To me, that's part of being alive. We're always thinking about that and being told how we should be. Mm-hmm. So classics is a way to look at all of that. But I'm aware someone could say that's also true if you want to study Victorian literature. You'd still learn a lot about human behavior there too. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, maybe classics, first of all, there seems to be less of it that exists. And when you're a classicist, you sort of run the whole, everything from poetry to history to mm-hmm. philosophy.
It's very interdisciplinary.
Yeah, archaeology mm-hmm. and even how writing is passed down on papyrus. So I love that. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of these other fields, you're just looking very much like at Victorian novels,
yeah.
but not the poetry.
Right. No, yeah. I agree. I mean, I was a philosophy major, but I was also a medieval studies major. Mm-hmm. And then I had this classics minor. And I really think that deeply impacted the kind of philosophy that I went on to produce. Because a lot of the medieval studies, that's, you know, an interdisciplinary track. It's one of those studies.
Yeah.
So it's not a department. But I read massive amounts of medieval literature, mm-hmm. right? And also medieval history and medieval philosophy. But you started to get this sense. And in my classics, Latin classes were like translated the Aeneid, right? Mm-hmm. So you're translating epic poems. You're reading, I don't know, Icelandic saga. Mm-hmm. And like the Song of Roland, which is like the Iliad of the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. It's really wild. And then you're doing philosophy, which, again, of course, you're reading Plato and Aristotle, and you always somehow start with Socrates in philosophy. Mm-hmm. But then contemporary philosophy is this very narrow thing. And so a lot of people, when they're doing contemporary philosophy, they get kind of locked into a problem. And I think this ends up being bad philosophy because it is completely cut off from literature. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, I have this philosophy and literature podcast for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's mostly selfish. It's mostly for me. but other people like it. But I do think that poetry, and here I suppose I'm explicitly disagreeing with Plato, but I do think that poetry is kind of necessary for philosophy, but certainly other disciplines, right? I happen to be a philosopher. Mm-hmm. If that's true, do you agree?
I do.
Okay. Yeah. So if that's true, it would strike me that poetry should be essential to general curriculum, right?
Yes.
And that there is a very strong case to be made, and that very few people are willing to make, for a variety of reasons, all of which I think are bad, that we should start with Homer.
Yes.
Why should we read Homer? Even if we're going to be engineers.
Why should we read Homer?
Or finance people. Why should we read Homer?
Well, first of all, tying in with what you said, there's a lot of philosophy in there. It's, I think many people read the Iliad and they read it for the narrative and what happens.
It's a good story.
It's a very good story. And so that's part of its artfulness. But there are scenes that ask us to think about what it means. I don't know. I think it's book five or something. There's a scene where...
That's where Diomedes starts to attack the gods.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm thinking of where Hector, which may be the same thing. Hector's on the ramparts with his wife, mm-hmm. Andromache, and she's holding their child. Mm-hmm. And this whole moment where she wants him not to go to war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He has to, in terms of who he is as a hero, as a man in the Greek sense of that. But this moment where he picks up his son, mm-hmm. and the son is playing with the plumes on the helmet.
Yes.
And to me, there's a whole window opened about tenderness and the weird, what does it mean to feel you are compelled to go into a war where you'll likely get killed, mm-hmm. but you also have this responsibility for this child, mm-hmm. and his wife. And those are moral questions to me that don't have clear answers. Mm-hmm. But there's something exciting about spending time there, I find.
Yes.
Or what does it mean to decide to go into the enemy camp as an old man to ransom your son's body and know that you might be killed. But it's that scene between the two of them at the end where there's a kind of grudging respect between mutual enemies, mm-hmm. and the need to trust somebody and the humanity that can come out of all the goriness of war to say, here's your son's body back. I acknowledge that that's the least I can do for you. So I don't know. I think we should read it again for the same reason I think we should study classics, to look at the moral questions there. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Aeneid. When I used to teach it to senior high school students, we'd read it. But in book four, I'd ask them, What do you think about what happens, how it plays out between Aeneas and Dido? Mm-hmm. What do you think about the fact that he basically uses her and then leaves because that's his heroic duty?
Yeah, he's got to go.
Yeah, and what do you think about the fact that she was doing nothing and then she is made by the gods to do that? And do we have gods we can blame for our behavior? And if not, then what explains it? Mm-hmm. And I think they were really fascinated with those questions. Mm-hmm. That's a very different thing from let's translate this line. Let's see if this is the ablative case or not. So it's a vast resource, it seems to me.
Yeah.
To start thinking about what it is to be human.
Yeah, I love it. I completely agree. This is my elevator pitch, by the way. But I didn't want to lead with that. I wanted to hear yours.
Yeah,
because, I mean, to me, when you are studying a tradition, which is some kind of coherent line of thought that you can see develop over time, sort of progress and then regress and then change. You know, for example, Homer is presenting in these epic poems a vision of excellence, right? But it's also, there are internal tensions and conflicts within this vision, but it's like a vision, and you can talk about Homeric arete, excellence, virtue, and contrast it with the account that we get in Plato and Aristotle. And then contrast it with what we get. I just taught this text, The Song of Roland, which is a medieval French epic poem where you really get a vision of the chivalrous knight and also a vision of Charlemagne as this Christian emperor, conqueror. And the similarities are so striking, right? I mean, you just see this. And to see ways that they try to Christianize it, right? This kind of pagan ideal. What does it look like to baptize that, or how does it change over time? To me, the value of doing that precisely is self-knowledge. I mean, that's the hope, that these are all attempts to express something about human excellence, which is always an expression of human nature, right? It's got what's our form of excellence. And I think it really doesn't matter at all whether you want to be a poet or you want to be a lawyer, the part of what it means to be educated, right, is to have a different kind of vision. And part of that comes from the poet.
I think so. And I think that for me, the questions to always be asking are, who am I? What am I? And I feel like it's important to have that, to keep asking it as one gets older. I think self-knowledge is a way of, once you understand yourself, you can have a better sense of how to interact with others, I suppose. And also, you can maybe understand others by their differences from you and by their similarities. But I don't feel, and maybe it never has been the case, but I don't feel our society fosters that idea of that kind of self-awareness. But I also think that most humans aren't wired to spend time there, which is another reason to study these texts and to study poetry. Because in the same way, I know it's kind of a cliche, but, you know, someone dies and then people always look for poems to read. For solace or to understand, make sense of the disorientation of it, of grief. And I think one of the things that poets do is they provide language for things that all of us feel, but not all of us know how to articulate it. And that doesn't mean that poets are better or anything. It's just a thing they can do. In the same way, sometimes music, without words at all, music can sum up something that I'm feeling more than I could say in words. And that's the reason to stay in touch with one's own humanity, but also to be reflective. And if you're not naturally a self-reflective person, then reading can at least allow you a small amount of time to spend thinking about those questions?
Yeah, I think that self-reflection, I mean, we're all capable of it, right? But I do think that young people live in a state of such distraction. We know it's rewiring their brains, in fact. So my daughter is 16 now, but when she was 10 or 11, I took her to the National Gallery in DC, and I could not really get her to focus on the art. And I said, well, you really need to step back and appreciate it and, like, hear the things you're looking for. And she, like, tried it out. And then at some point she said, Mom, I can't look at anything for more than 10 seconds. And I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
That is really bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was one of those parents that I don't let my children have a cell phone until they're 16, but their schools required iPads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that capacity for attention is destroyed.
Yeah.
And that is a moral capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is our capacity to pay attention, to focus, to direct our attention here or there, to take in, to be receptive, to contemplate. Mm-hmm. Right. And literature demands that kind of sustained attention that I think young people really struggle to do. They can do it in contexts where they feel like something is at stake.
Mm-hmm.
They can get through the organic chemistry.
Yeah.
Because they want to go to med school. But I think with Homer or things like this, it's kind of like, what's the ROI, as the administrators say?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's all consumption, what evidence you have for the value. I'm just getting ready to retire from my university, but for years when I've had leaves, then I'm supposed to turn in a letter that sort of shows exactly what I produced,
sure,
how I produced it, how many hours were spent.
And your annual report.
Right. And it's mm-hmm. very hard to say, well, you know, I did a lot of walking on the beach. I thought a lot. Sometimes yeah. I read some novels. Once in a while, I wrote a poem. Yeah. And that sounds terrible to some kinds of deans.
It sounds terrible to a bean counter, yes.
Yes. And I've only had deans who were scientists in all this time. So there's not even an understanding of what the humanities are sometimes.
Yeah. Which I think is already a failure.
Yes.
Of the way our universities are structured.
I agree.
Our scientists are like, what's poetry?
Right.
That's already like a sign of...
It's a problem. So there's an understanding about you have this many books or you have these prizes or something. That's something they can put down mm-hmm. and quantify. But trying to explain to them how you arrive at these things is very difficult. So I don't know. I feel it seems too bad, this whole idea of attention not being paid or the idea that it's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I have seen how I myself have become this way where... At the end of the day, I'll sort of go through a checklist of what I accomplished. And I'll think, you know, it would be okay, Carl, if all you did was sit around all day and read or just hang out with your dog. But for some reason, I have to prove
That's
to myself I was productive.
That's hard for Americans to say to themselves.
Yeah. You know, something interesting that happened during lockdown, the novelist Yi Yun Lee decided to do an online slow read of War and Peace. And I had wanted to read this book for years, but never could do it.
Yeah.
And she assigned each day... 10 pages, sometimes 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then people would write in online all day about what they were thinking about what they read.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never read like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us 3 months or something. I was astonished when we finished the book. But also I thought, you know, Carl, you always could have done this.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, I'm the kind who thinks I've got to read like 60 pages of this book
mm-hmm.
right now,
mm-hmm.
which is a little too much for some mm-hmm. books. Or like a book of poetry, you can read one poem and put it down.
Mm-hmm.
But I always think I've got to read it in one mm-hmm. sitting. So even I have to remind myself that taking time, and the less you read, the more time you can focus on each word, each mm-hmm. sentence.
Yeah. I mean, the beauty of poetry, well, this is not true for epic poems.
Right.
But the beauty of so much poetry is that it's digestible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you can just kind of curl up with it instead of scrolling Instagram. My family makes fun of me for so many reasons, but I never go anywhere without a book.
Mm-hmm.
Literally nowhere. Like I will just have a book. There's a book in every bag.
Yeah.
And it's because there's always this weird downtime, no matter what you're doing. And if you have a book with you,
yeah,
your downtime is like this weird pleasure time.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be amazed how much you can read just waiting for your doctor or whatever. And poetry is so great for this. And you can't really substitute your phone because, well, at least I can't, because what happens with me is I pick up my phone, I see 150 notifications,
yes,
my anxiety spikes,
mm-hmm.
and then I start responding to emails
mm-hmm.
because it never stops for me anyway, and especially now that I'm an administrator, it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to very intentionally break yourself out of that cycle of distraction.
Yeah.
Because the email can wait. I don't have to respond to this email in the parking lot at night before bed. Like,
mm-hmm.
you don't need to hear from me.
Yeah.
It's fine. I should, in fact, read poetry. But I think the problem is that so many good people don't understand that claim that you need to read poetry. I remember in my old university, we used to have famous writers come in, and Jonathan Franzen came in one time, and somebody had asked him, how do we create more readers? And he was just like, you don't, and you don't need to. Some people like to read. Great. I write novels for them. Everyone else, they like other things. I disagree really strongly with this. Now, granted, I was a bookworm from probably three on. So he would say, no, this is just like a niche thing. This is you, and you don't understand other people. But I sort of want to say, no, I mean, it is important. Of course, the Iliad was not a book. People weren't reading it, right? They were listening to it. And so poetry in particular has this experiential, communal, auditory aspect to it. I want to say it's necessary. I want to go maximally strong here. You're not with me. I can tell.
It's not that. I want it to be that poetry is necessary, but I feel as if it is art necessary. I think, well, it adds all these other textures to daily life. But can life exist without it?
Oh, sure. And we could survive.
Right. And I used to think it was strange when I'd meet people who didn't read on a regular basis. I just think, what do they do? And then I realized I was the strange one, actually, or at least in the minority. So in that sense, I don't know. Like my partner, for example, is not a regular reader. Yet he reads constantly the Washington Post and all the keeps up with all this politics, which I don't do. I don't let that stuff enter my world. Not that I don't want to know the news, but I don't want to be bogged down every second about it.
I don't either.
And I feel as if, well, I'm getting the news about what it's like to be human and alive by reading my novel or something. But I'm aware that that's also, there's some escapism sometimes to that. Though I don't think poetry is escapism necessarily, at least the kind of poems I write. I feel like it's inviting people to think hard about stuff they don't necessarily want to think about. But I don't know. I kind of agree with Franzen about that. That it's like, it's a thing I do, and I would love it if more people wanted to read poetry, but I don't want to fault them if they don't. But I also think maybe other things should count. So a lot of people do enjoy listening to music. And like pop music and that kind of thing. And there is poetry there. It's, there's language and rhythm and patterns, speech patterns and things being played with. Or in a stretch, I'm capable of seeing the poetry in a good baseball play. But I think, is that poetry or is it just an athletic coordination? I don't know. But
I mean, it's form. You're seeing a kind of form there.
Yeah, I try to think, well, you know, maybe poetry isn't limited to language, Carl. And maybe not everyone has access in the same way, or not everyone likes to look at paintings on a wall.
Well, I mean, that can be true. There are different art forms. Yeah. I think that people can survive without art. However, art does seem to be a very necessary human impulse. You can think about, I mean, like cave art is amazing, that this need to represent ourselves back to ourselves in this way.
Yes.
And not just ourselves, right? Like a lot of cave art's just like, there's a precursor of the buffalo, like whatever that thing is. But if we're thinking about not just surviving, but thriving, where you are invested in, I would say, the permanent things, right? I think there is an element of escapism in fiction insofar as you are obviously taking yourself outside of the busyness of the everyday world and you're entering something made up, right? It's made up. But I think in the proper spirit, it's very much a plunge into reality. And this, like, to me, there's a deep connection, and now I say this as a philosopher who's thought a lot about it, that there is a really strong connection between art and truth.
Yes.
It's not as obvious as, I don't know, the connection between physics and truth or chemistry and truth, but there's nevertheless a very strong and deep connection there.
I agree. I think it's a push towards truth. I think literature tries to tease out the questions and to get closer to understanding, like about love. You know, Valentine's Day just happened. So, you know, we're used to the stock Valentine's cards and those messages. But literature gets at what is love actually? What has it been? What can it be? And it strips away all that idealism, even in a lot of the escapist kind of fiction. And as for poetry, well, as for art overall, I'm going to do something obnoxious and quote something by me.
No, but, do it. Go
but
for
a
it.
A line that I do lean on a lot from my poems is this thing where I say it's a human need to give to shapelessness a form.
Absolutely.
And I feel like when you talked about the cave paintings, I mean, part of it is just wanting to give shape to what we see in the world, the water buffalo or whatever it might be, ourselves doing something. But a lot of it is abstraction. And what do I do with this feeling? And what do I do with this sorrow or this joy? And I think many of us, there's an impulse to make a form to contain it, if only briefly, which doesn't have to be a poem. And I even think it can be food and making something out of generosity and wanting to make someone happy with a pie, I guess. So I think if it's true that it's a human need, then that means these other people who don't go to literature do need it. They just have to have it brought before them, maybe.
Right. So I wonder, so you're about to retire.
Yes, shockingly.
Yeah, congrats.
Thank you.
Where do you see poetry in 50 years? Does it have a strong place anymore in our universities? Or does the poet really have to make his or her life somewhere else? I mean, obviously, poetry far predates the university, which is a medieval institution, and has miraculously survived the centuries and changed itself to meet the needs of society. You know, where is poetry in 50 years? Is it thriving?
Well, assuming human beings are thriving.
So, let's just go with that assumption. Let's be optimistic.
I think it will be, because even though there are always these reports like poetry is dead or no one reads poetry, but what I see is more and more people exploring poetry outside the academy. So that kind of narrow studying of poetry, that's one thing that might be endangered. But there are so many people, especially historically marginalized people who have found more platforms now, especially with the internet. There's always a need for self-expression, but especially when you feel you haven't been allowed to talk about your race or whatever your culture may be. And I think that there's been a kind of renaissance of poetry because of all of those voices coming out. So it seems to me as if I would have said poetry was endangered if it's something that only some in the academy write books and have these publishers. But when it can be everywhere and it's something that anyone can feel is important to them, I assume that means it can proliferate more. And also because I think poetry always is a result of pressure in some way, given climate change and all of that, I think there are going to be, again, it's that thing of giving shapelessness a form. So people are going to want to address those issues that will become more urgent.
Yeah. So just one follow-up question. So if we think of poetry as just kind of spontaneously coming out of the human, out of some need, it's always going to be there. But if it is somehow broken away from, or it's not informed by tradition, in the sense of poetic form is something that we keep transmitting, and it changes, right? Nobody's really writing epic poems anymore.
Right.
Are they?
I don't think so.
Yeah. And there's a lot of revolutionary changes in poetry in the 20th century in particular. And do you think, just to ask a really loaded question, but one that I genuinely struggle with, do you think that poetry needs to be advanced within a tradition? So even if you look at the brilliant modernists, you can't really understand them and appreciate them or their genius unless you see what they're doing. You can't understand what they're doing unless you kind of have a sense of the poetic forms they had received.
Right. So like the canon, that kind of thing.
So not so much a canon. I just feel like canon is one of these words that breaks brains for no reason. So just think in terms of received poetic forms, right? And does poetry need to be sustained by that?
Well, I think all poetry is patterned language. So that goes without saying.
Yes.
And as someone who I just for the last time taught my history of prosody in English seminar, and I always have students there who want to know, like, why are we reading this Shakespeare? Why is it important to think about it? But at the end of it, they have to build their own form.
Yeah.
And they realize that it starts with, okay, well, I can take this from this rhyming couplet idea from Shakespeare's sonnets, or I can do this from the haiku tradition or whatever it may be. So I think, yes, it is important to know the history of what comes from what. I think what I try to be is a little more open to how they get that information. Of course, I would like it to be that everyone reads all of Shakespeare's sonnets.
Mm-hmm.
But if they instead begin with Gwendolyn Brooks's sonnets, mm-hmm. and they've never heard of Shakespeare, but she's still writing sonnets, or if they want to look at someone much more contemporary, like Henri Cole doing a version of a sonnet, and as long as then there's this spirit of inquiry to say, well, where does this come from? And then make room for looking back.
Mm-hmm.
But I think sometimes we in education have made it seem as if, well, you can't even think of being a poet if you haven't read these things that we've determined are great.
Yes.
And that's where there's this resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the tradition is much longer now if you're 20 years old than when I was 20 years old. I mean, there's a lot more to catch up on.
Yeah.
So I don't blame them if they don't know a lot of modernists, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I think part of being a human being is to constantly want to learn. So maybe not this year, but maybe sometime you decide to look at some of the older stuff.
Yeah.
But also in other traditions, because sometimes we only point to something that's a very white tradition or American, but reminding people that there's a whole tradition of poems in African countries, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the problem with poetry for people now, I mean, this is in some sense my experience when I was younger, that people worry about not getting it, or they feel like it's too remote or it's too recondite or it's somehow not for them. I felt that way about modernism when I was younger. I was like, well, I don't know what's going on here. And you're sort of afraid to admit, I don't get it is a hard thing to just say.
Right.
But that's how I felt reading The Wasteland the first time. I was like, look, some of this is obviously beautiful, but as a whole, I don't get it.
I don't really get it now. I, you know, I've read books that tell me what I'm supposed to get, but I would never think that. And I don't know how I should be expected to. But just this morning, I saw a clip on my phone of Lucille Clifton answering some question. And she said that the mistake that teachers make is telling students that poetry is about finding answers when she said it's really about asking questions. And I find that's really true. The best poems don't wrap it all up. But I remember in high school being told this is the right answer. Like if you repeated what the teacher said, this poem's about this, fine. Even though inside I would think I had some other thoughts.
Right.
But there wasn't room for that.
Yes.
So, but the idea that no, it's a constant inquiry or kind of a quest as opposed to arrival.
Right. Yes. I think a lot of the problem is the way poetry is taught and the way that poetry is assessed.
Yeah.
So I've got six kids, so I've seen a lot in terms of education.
Yes.
And it really broke my heart the way that poetry was being taught to my children. Really technical.
Mm-hmm.
All of the assessments were like just trying to break it down technically. And the result was that my children were not loving poetry.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not the way. Right. It would be far better if your assessment was memorizing the poem or keeping a journal about it or explaining what you did or didn't appreciate about it or exploring its meaning. Right.
Yeah.
And it's not about this is the meaning.
Right.
This is a poem about a river.
Right. But what does it provoke?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. And anyway, that's not a problem that we're going to resolve this morning.
No.
This was really fun. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts about poetry. I'm really grateful.
Thank you. I am too.
You have been listening to Sacred and Profane Love, a podcast hosted by the Honors College at the University of Tulsa. To learn more about the Honors College, please go to our website, utulsa.edu/honors. To learn more about this podcast, you can check out its website, sacredandprofanelove.com. On the website, you'll find an archive of all our past episodes and guests, and also a blog where we post news related to the work that we do. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter, where our handle is @eudaimoniapod. Finally, if you would like to support this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/eudaimoniapod. Patrons receive podcast swag and subscriptions with our literary partners, The Point Magazine, Switchyard Magazine, and The Lamp Magazine. We are grateful to our partners for their ongoing support.